Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is September 13th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Living and Giving, a Look at 2 Corinthians, Personal Stewardship, presented by Knight Wells. The number for this tape is WEK2002-05. Let's listen in.
So let's just begin with a word of prayer, and then we'll jump right in. Gracious God, we again thank you for the gift of this day and for your presence in our lives always. We thank you that you've given to us your word, and we just pray that each time we look at it that we might find something new and something that helps us and brings us closer to you. Help us in our relationships to be conscious of your presence, but most of all, help us in our relationship with you. In Jesus' name we pray. Mm-hmm. Okay, as I said the last couple of times, the conjecture among many scholars is that chapters 10 through 13 were actually written before chapters 1 through 9, and that they do in fact refer to the painful letter which Paul talks about in chapter 2 of this book. Now again, it's not definitive, but I'm sure if you read these four chapters, you can certainly tell there's a different tone and a different perspective. So I thought what would be kind of fun to do, and since we're just a small group today, I think we can do this very easily, and that is, if particularly chapters 10 and 11, Paul is sort of rebutting or answering his critics. Okay, he's responding to. Now, we don't know what the criticism was exactly, but it might be kind of fun to see if we can deduce or figure out this is his answer. Now, what was the question? What was this charge against him? I think it would be kind of fun to see if we can pick that out, and there's some ways in which we can do that. The first verse in chapter 10, I'm not sure how your translation goes, but in this RSV it says, I, Paul, myself, entreat you by the meekness and the gentleness of Christ, I who am humble when face to face with you, but bold to you when I am away. Now, anybody have a little different translation of that first verse, chapter 10?
That's good news. It says, I, Paul, make a personal appeal to you, I... who I'm said to be meek and mild, but when I'm with you, but harsh with you when I'm away. By the gentleness and kindness of Christ, I beg you not to force me to be harsh when I come. For I am sure I can deal harshly with those who say that we act from worldly motives.
Okay. So we've got that word, I've got gentleness. The meekness and gentleness of Christ. Anybody have a different translation of that? One of the translations that I found is, this is, I, Paul, call upon you, and I'm doing it in the gentleness and the sweet reasonableness of Christ. Now, I've got magnanimity here, which is another translation of that. But I picked out those two words because I thought these were they're sort of a setting for what Paul is saying. They sort of say, this is my perspective now as I'm going to answer your charges against me. But the first word, this sweet gentleness, the Greek word is prautes, translated as gentleness. And what that literally means in the Greek is it has to do with anger. And it has to do with the idea that if you carry the sense of gentleness, you know when it's appropriate to be angry and when it's not appropriate to be angry. And if you think about Aristotle, you know, with the golden mean, everything was, you know, nothing in excess and that type of thing. Prautes, in that sense, you know, you never became angry at personal attacks. But you could become angry when others were being treated unjustly. So it's sort of a righteous anger. And that's how Paul is presenting his defense. He's not taking it personally. He's saying, I'm answering these, you know, in the sense of what is appropriate for me to be upset about with you and, you know, the way you're living in your community. But this other word is epiakeia, which is translated literally sweet reasonableness, and that has the same kind of a flavor where it refers to justice, but it refers to justice not just like the letter of the law, not just this is you shall not kill, you know, that means you don't kill anybody, and if you don't kill anybody it doesn't mean you're doing anything wrong, but more the spirit of the law. And the spirit, of course, for Paul has to do with the spirit of love, because everything he does, and again go back to that 1 Corinthians 13 chapter, that his philosophy is based on a relationship of love. So when he begins his defenses, he's saying, I'm doing this in the spirit of love. I'm not taking what you say against me personally. And if I do seem angry, you know, it is because of things that are appropriate, not things that are inappropriate. Now, having said that, let's go and look at his answers, and let's see if we can, as we read along, let's see if we can figure out what the critics were saying about him. And again, remember the critics were this individual person that he talked about earlier in the book, but also the Judaizers, who were very critical of what he was doing and his authority and that type of a thing. So, Don, if I pick on you, just keep reading a little bit. Let's at least go down to the end of chapter, I should say verse 6, and see
how it is far. True that we live in the world, but we do not fight from worldly motives. The weapons we use in our fight are not the world's weapons, but God's powerful weapons, which we use to destroy strongholds. We destroy false arguments. We pull down every proud obstacle that is raised against the knowledge of God. We take every thought captive and make it obey Christ. And after you have proved your complete loyalty, we will be ready to punish any act of disloyalty. You are looking at the outward appearance of things. Is there someone there who reckons himself to belong to Christ? Well, let him think again about himself, because we belong to Christ just as much as he does. For I am not ashamed, even if I have boasted somewhat too much about the authority that the Lord has given us, authority to build you up, not to tear you down. I do not want it to appear that I am trying to frighten you with my letters. Someone will say, Paul's letters are severe and strong, but when he is with us in person, he is weak and his words are nothing. Such a person must understand that there is no difference between what we write in our letters when we are away and what we will do when we are there with you. Of course, we would not dare to classify ourselves or compare ourselves with those who rate themselves so highly. How stupid they are. They make up their own standards to measure themselves by, and they judge themselves by their own standards. As for us, however, our boasting will not go beyond certain limits. It will stay within the limits of the work which God has set for us, and this includes our work among you. And since you are within those limits, we were not going beyond them when we came to you, bringing the good news about Christ. So we do not boast about the work that others have done beyond the limits of God set for us. Instead, we hope that your faith may grow and that we may be able to do a much greater work among you, always within the limits that God has set. Then we can preach the good news in other countries beyond you and shall not have to boast about work already done in another man's field.
Okay, that's good. Okay, so what are they saying about Paul from what we can tell, first of all?
He's one person when he's away and another when he's there.
Right. Okay, so kind of this charge of being two-faced, okay? You know, you write these real big letters, but when you're with us, you know, you kind of back off and that kind of stuff, okay? Two-faced, difference between being present and being away.
Okay. What else do you see there as a charge against him?
Well, he was talking about boasting, but as though he were essentially lording it up about his relationship with Christ. And I'm one of the disciples.
Holier than thou.
Pardon?
Holier than thou.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kind of self-righteous type thing.
Yeah.
Right? Anything else you see there? Or he's
He talks also about preaching the word in other countries, but he seems to feel he needs to get things settled in Corinth before he launches out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he keeps talking about a he. I mean, obviously there must be one
kind of leader
on his side.
Right. And like we mentioned a day or so ago, that person is sort of an we don't know who that is, but you're right, there's a kind of a leader of the pack that's in there, giving Paul, the leader of the loyal opposition, that's really giving him a hard time. And doing so after he's left, you know, kind of a thing. So to just real briefly to these charges, what does Paul say about the fact that they call him two-faced? And what does he say there in his little answer to them? I think that's in the early part there.
He's obeying Christ.
Right. He isn't any different in person than he is in this letter. And you're right. He's obeying Christ in his concern for them. And again, Paul gets back to this thing. You know, the reason I'm saying these things to you is out of love. It's this kind of a tough love kind of an issue as far as he's concerned. How about this, the boasting part about it? What does he say? What is his response to that charge? What does he say? Why does he boast or sound like he's boasting?
He says, "For I'm not ashamed, even if I have boasted somewhat too much about the authority that the Lord has given us, authority to build you up, not tear you down."
Right. So it's not that he's building himself up, is he building up Christ? I mean, that's the whole issue. Okay, he's not bragging about how wonderful a Christian he is. He's building up Christ. Okay? And then, as far as his attention to the Corinthians, what's that all about? Why does he spend time with them first, you might say?
Because they're disobedient.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the problem is. I mean, he's got these other churches he's going to deal with, but he wants to... We're on chapter 10, we're just sort of...
Sorry,
that's all right.
Wait for the man.
No problem, we're just starting on chapter 10. So, yeah, that's exactly right. Now, let's go on with chapter 11 a little bit and see if we can figure out some more charges against Paul. Someone else want to start reading there at the beginning of chapter 11?
"I wish you would bear with me in a little foolishness. Do you bear with me? I feel a divine jealousy for you, for I promised you in marriage to one husband to present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. But I am afraid that as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes and proclaims another Jesus than the one we proclaim, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you submit to it readily enough. I think that I am not in the least inferior to these super apostles. I may be untrained in speech, but not in knowledge. Certainly in every way and in all things we have made this evident to you. Did I commit a sin by humbling myself so that you might be exalted because I proclaimed God's good news to you free of charge? I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you. And when I was with you and was in need, I did not burden anyone, for my needs were supplied by the friends who came from Macedonia. So I refrained, and I will continue to refrain from burdening you in any way. As the truth of Christ is in me, this boast of mine will not be silenced in the regions of Achaia. And why? Because I do not love you. God knows I do.
Okay, let's stop there a minute. There's a couple of charges there that are pretty obvious. What's one of them? Early on there. What about Paul's ability to talk?
Well, he said he's not a great speaker.
You know, the guy cannot preach a sermon, you know. He cannot preach a sermon. He can't talk. Okay, so Paul can't preach. Okay, and what's the next one? It has to do with money.
He's being paid from other... They're not having funded being there. He's being paid by the churches of Macedonia.
Right. You know, they're questioning his use of the funds. Okay? And then what does Paul say to both of those things? In terms of the fact that they don't think he can speak very well, what does he say?
Well, maybe I can't speak well, but I have a lot of knowledge.
Exactly. You know, I might not be the greatest preacher in the world, but I do know what I'm talking about. Okay, so forget about the presentation and good get down to the message. And then what about the money issue?
He hasn't burdened this church with any.
Right. You know, right now... They're asking for this gift to the church in Jerusalem, but he's not at this stage, at least, has not been burdening them in terms of any kind of monetary support. Okay, let's go on with verse 12.
Before we do that, I just reflecting back to 10 here, where he is described as being sort of humble and shy in face-to-face situations, but when he writes, becomes more bold. This business here is stating that I'm not really very eloquent in speech, mm-hmm. but in writing, perhaps that word comes out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good point. You know, it's an interesting thing. I was doing some of the background reading. It is such a different culture. Again, you know, in our time, we talk a lot about the fact that teachers and educators, you know, are not that well paid in terms of you compare people in the teaching profession, even in the college university, you compare their income versus, you know, CEOs or professional baseball players or whatever you want to call it. In Paul's time and in the Roman world, if you were a teacher or a learned person in rhetoric, you received huge amounts of money. I mean, the kings and the princes and would pay big bucks to have you as part of their entourage. I mean, they just had a whole different viewpoint in terms of the philosophers and the academicians of their time had a much higher level. And some of these, what Paul refers to as these super apostles, you know, they were probably better trained than he in some of this oral communication and were able to do the kind of things that he was not able to do. But, you know, that's just a difference in culture. And Don and I were talking a little bit before you came in, but there's a part here, I want to read this to you real quickly here, if I can do, it has to do with Paul's appearance, because they made some sort of disparaging remarks about how he looked. Well, here's the thing I was going to tell you about these rhetoricians. It said, there never was an age in which a man who could talk made as much money as in ancient times. Augustus, the Roman governor, paid Varius Flaccus, the rhetorician, an annual salary of 100,000 sesterces, which in present-day purchasing power would be the equivalent of $250,000. Every town was entitled to grant complete exemption from all civic burdens and taxes to a certain number of teachers of rhetoric and literature. Paul's independence was something that the Corinthians could not understand in terms of his ability. But let's see if I can find this thing about Paul, because it is kind of interesting. Do you have my glasses? I told Susan to bring my glasses on, but I can't see some of this stuff as well. Okay, here it is. Now this comes, understand this is not scriptural, but this comes from Paul's personal appearance. His bodily presence, the Corinthians said, was weak. He was no speaker, and it may well be that they were right. A description of Paul's personal appearance had come down from us from a very early book called The Acts of Paul and Thecla, which dates to about the year 200. It is so unflattering that it may well be true. It describes Paul this way: a man of small stature, thin-haired upon the head, crooked in the legs, of good state of body, eyebrows meeting, with a nose somewhat hooked, full of grace, for sometimes he appeared like a man and sometimes he had the face of an angel. A little, balding, bandy-legged man with a hooked nose and shaggy eyebrows is not a very impressive picture, and it may well be that the Corinthians made great sport of making fun of him. So again, you know, we don't know if that's absolutely the way he looked, but that's from another version, I guess, of his appearance. Okay, let's go on then with verse 12, and let's see if we can figure out these last few charges that they are making against him. Anybody else want to read?
And what I do, I will continue to do in order to undermine a claim of those who would like to claim that in their boasted mission they work on the same terms as we do. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So it is not strange if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. Their end will correspond to their deeds. I repeat, let no one think me foolish, but even if you do, accept me as a fool, so that I too may boast a little. What am I saying? I say not on the Lord's authority, but as a fool, in this boastful confidence. Since many boast of worldly things, I too will boast, for you gladly bear with fools, being wise yourselves. For you bear it if a man makes slaves of you, or preys upon you, or takes advantage of you, or puts on airs, or strikes you in the face. To my shame, I must say, we are too weak for that. But whatever anyone dares to boast of, I am speaking as a fool. I also dare to boast of that. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I am a better one. I am talking like a madman, with far greater labors, far more imprisonments, with countless beatings, and often near death. And then he said five times.
Okay, let's stop for a minute. So what are some of the charges going on here? What are they saying? That Paul is not what?
He's not knowledgeable enough.
Not knowledgeable. But look specifically at verse 22.
Yeah, they're saying
he's not a Hebrew, he's not an Israelite, he's not a descendant of Abraham. To which Paul says, wait a minute. So he's talking here about he doesn't have the right credentials. And these critics are coming up and are saying, well, You know, we have more, we have better credentials than Paul. But Paul says, no, I am a Hebrew. And I do come from descendants of Abraham. I mean, I'm a Jew, just like these other supposed super apostles. Are they servants of Christ? I'm a better one. And then he goes down and lists all the things that he's gone through over the last several years and see if they can stand up to that. And then he goes down and says, you know, I'm talking like a madman. Maybe you sound like I'm crazy, but, you know, I've had more labors, more imprisonments, more beatings. I was near death. 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews 50 lashes less one. 3 times I've been beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I've been shipwrecked at night. And a day I've been adrift at sea, on frequent journeys, in danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger with false brethren, toil and hardship, though many a sleepless night, in hunger and thirst, without food and cold and exposure, and apart from all other things, there is the daily pressure of me, of my anxiety, that is my concern for the churches. Who is weak and I am not weak? Who made to fall and I am not indignant? So there again, he's saying, you know, remember, I'm not taking this personally, but by the way, I have done a few things in the service of Christ. So if I must boast, then he says, I'm going to boast about the things that show my weakness. Now that's always Paul's big, that's where he comes with that famous verse, you know, I can do all things in Christ. Who comforts me, sustains me. And Paul's a big one to talk about, you know, strength and weakness. Okay? You know, when I am weak, then I am strong. Very, very important for Paul's theology and for his understanding of the faith. So that when he undergoes all these persecutions and all these difficult times, that really then becomes a sign not of his weakness, but of God's strength, because God helps him through all these difficult periods in his life. So again, every time Paul says these things, and it sounds like he's boasting and bragging and all that stuff, but he says, please understand that when I say these things, I'm not building myself up. I'm showing you how dependent I am upon God and how God sustains me through all these things I have to deal with.
So I assume from the comments that his detractors must also have come from Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Just
mm-hmm.
Were they sort of following him around?
Right.
Those naysayers.
Exactly. You know, and I think that was one of the things that frustrated Paul so much, is he'd come up there, he'd start a church and get things going. They didn't show in these Judaizers from the mother church, and they started knocking what he was doing. And that's what's all the more ironic about when he goes back and asks for these contributions for the church back in Jerusalem, which has given him all this hassle, and yet he's trying to raise money for them because they're in trouble.
I guess he's saying here too that in the answer to the charge that he's not qualified, and he's saying, "Well, you're not qualified. Look what I've been through."
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
At least not qualifications. No.
Right. Exactly. I mean, what else do you want me to do? Yeah.
I wear my spurs.
Right. And of course, his whole thing about, you know, some people charge that, you know, Paul was not one of the 12 apostles. He came later. You know, he was a persecutor of the church before. But Paul's argument was always that I was not one of the 12, but I saw Jesus. I experienced Christ on the road to Damascus. I know the Lord, and that makes me an apostle just as much as Peter or John or James or anybody else. So that was always his argument back in terms of his authority.
So there's sort of a closed union there in the apostles.
Right. And that was the whole thing with what they call the Judaizers. I mean, they wanted to connect this directly with Jesus and with Jerusalem. And they were not at all excited about having this particular new way of looking at religion have anything to do with the non-Jewish people. I mean, it was a closed group. That was the party of the circumcised versus the uncircumcised. You had to be Jewish first before you could be Christian, you know. And we have, you know, when you think about some of the implications of that, denominational-wise, you know, you have certain groups within the family of Christianity that see themselves as the true true group, you know. There's that old story about the guy who gets to heaven, and he gets a tour by St. Peter and all the different areas up there, and Peter is taking him along the road, and he says, well, over here we have most of the Episcopalians, and over here we have the Lutherans, and over here we have the Methodists, and over here we have the Baptists, over down there are the Roman Catholics. But he says, be very quiet when you go through this next section, because those are the Missouri Synod Lutherans. They think they're the only ones there. You can pick any group you want to put in that category. But that's the that's kind of what Paul is saying, and what he had to deal with, because he was trying to get the Christian faith out into the world, go into all the world. And the people, the Judaizers, were trying to keep it in Jerusalem. And of course, the book of Acts says, you know, you will go to Jerusalem and then out into the world, and it's not where they were at. So then in verse 30 he says, so if I must boast, I'll boast in the things that show my weakness. The God and Father of the Lord Jesus, who is blessed forever, knows that I do not lie. At Damascus, the governor under King Ardius guarded the city of Damascus in order to seize me, but I was let down in a basket through the window of the wall and escaped his hands. I must boast, there is nothing to be gained by it, but I will go on to visions and revelations of the Lord. Well, the rest of the chapter again continues to be Paul's, defense. So let's look at a couple of these questions on the very back of the page here, to kind of get a little bit. Could you all bring those along? Everybody got a copy? Did you get a copy of this?
I have one.
Just, I got plenty. Take it with you. I made plenty. They're yours. What would you say? The first question, how would you describe Paul's self-concept? How do you think he felt about himself, both as a person as well as an apostle?
Qualified.
Mm-hmm. I think he also recognized that he had a little bit of weakness, in the sense that he kind of admits he's not a good speaker, but he's also very strong letter writer, and so
sure.
And he feels also that he's as much an apostle as the 12.
Right. 12. So his self-concept would probably be pretty strong, mm-hmm. internally, you know, even though he's got things he knows he can't do. But he does feel strongly committed to the cause of Christ and to the spreading of the gospel. So what do you think his sense of call is? I mean, from what you can deduce, at least from this letter.
He's driven.
He is. He is. Very much so. Type A personality. He's on a mission.
He's committed.
Well, Susie, what was that one thing you were reading, that attitude, is it my paintbrush, that book, had you bring that along?
No.
Huh. Well, I think if I can remember this thing, there's a little, you know this book called, what is it, Attitude is My Paintbrush?
Yeah, Colors All Situations.
Yeah, it's kind of like what, you know, the message, of course, is all of us see things different, and how we see things determines, you know, how we act or how we live and so forth. But there was one little, she was reading this to me yesterday at breakfast, there was this one little paragraph that said, and it's kind of a sort of a self-analysis or self-reflection, but it had kind of this question. If everybody in my congregation felt about the church the way I do, supported the church the way I do.
Volunteered
the way I do, et cetera, et cetera. What kind of a congregation would we have, you know? And it's kind of just a self-reflective question, but sometimes in terms of church life, it's so easy to critique others in terms of what they're doing or not doing. And this is just one of those little things that's sort of like a self-check. Well, let's look what I'm doing, you know. And I don't know, if you've been parts of congregations over the years like we have, it's so easy to fall into the trap of saying, if only they would do da-da-da-da-da-da. And rarely is it this idea of what is it that I, as an individual Christian, am doing to build up the community. But certainly in Paul's case, he was totally committed and had a very strong sense of calling to be an apostle and a proclaimer of the gospel. Look at that verse. We read that earlier, but look at the verses 12 through 18 just real quickly again in the 10th chapter. And the question there is, what is Paul's admonition when it comes to comparing ourselves with others? What does he really say we ought to beware of?
He says people that do that don't show good sense.
Right. They're without understanding. And that's, I think, one of the things, too, that is often, I don't know what your experience has been, but so often, I think, in the community of the church, there is a sense of sometimes, let's say, put it this way, I always call it the comparison game. But it's kind of this idea that, well, I can always find someone who isn't as good as I am. And likewise, I can probably also find someone who is always more than I am. And when it comes to spiritual life or spiritual journey, it's so important, I think, to be to refrain from that kind of judgment that we place on other people, that we assume maybe we know everything about their spiritual life, but we really don't know anything, kind of thing. And one of my best examples of that came from a member. This is in a former community where we lived in Illinois. I'd just done a funeral for a guy who had been suffering from a genetic disorder. It was very much like ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. It wasn't ALS, but it was just, I mean, this guy was an athletic director at the high school, big strapping guy, and he had got this genetic problem, and it just kept getting weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker. And by the time he passed away, he couldn't swallow. I mean, he just. But I'd visit him often and bring communion to him, and we had a good, very close relationship. And he was just a man of strong faith. And after the service, I had a guy that came from the local Baptist church that came to me and sort of asked the question. Well, he says, you know, you said some interesting things about him and mentioned his faces, but did he know the Lord? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, first of all, I thought, what a sort of an inappropriate question to ask me, mm-hmm. and for him to even think about that he was somehow judging this individual about his relationship with Christ, you know, and making the comparison in his mind, did he know the Lord, which meant did he have a relationship with Christ, and, you know, was he a faithful Christian? And to make that sort of ask that question sort of in limbo without even knowing the guy, you know. And so often, I think, within the church, we run the danger of making judgments upon other persons' spirituality or faith, depth of faith or whatever, and oftentimes without really knowing what they've been through, what they've experienced, and who they are as people. You know, you just assume, you know, they're this or they're that, or they're not this or they're not that. And so Paul says, you know, that's a dangerous thing when it comes to comparing ourselves with other people. We talked a little about number four, what's the purpose of Paul's defense of his actions? Again, it's not to build himself up, but to build our God. Look real quickly at chapter 12 and verses 7 through 10. And the question there is, what is the role of humility in Paul's ministry? Specifically, I said verses 7 through 10.
In a way, this it's question four, though, he's he's kind of saying, look, I've been there, done that, and have the t-shirt, and these people have not really done anything. So he's defending his actions, certainly in the sense of representing the Lord, but he's also saying in part that these people don't have his background.
His credentials, yeah.
His credentials, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Is he saying also if he loses humility, he loses touch with Christ?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's the whole thing. And then this is where he's got the famous reference to the thorn in his flesh, which nobody exactly knows what that is either. Whether that was actually a physical ailment, you know, a disease that he struggled with. And for all we know, he could have had a terrible case of emphysema or something like that. I don't know. Or whether it was individual people that were just these Judaizers that were continually after him to critique him. But verse 7 says, to keep me from being too elated by the abundance of revelations from God, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from being too elated. But then the famous verse 9 said, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. When I'm weak, then I am strong.
Yeah, this one just refers to a painful physical ailment, you know.
Yeah. And that's probably one of the more common or classic explanations for that thorn in the flesh. Then question number 6, what do we understand by the meaning of chapter 13, verse 5? He says, examine yourselves to see whether you are holding to your faith. Test yourselves. Do you not realize that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you fail to meet the test. What's that all about, do you think? Examine yourselves to see whether you are holding your faith. Test yourselves. Do you not realize that Jesus Christ is in you? I mean, do you ever have these experiences where, you know, something happens in your life and, you know, you refer to it as a test or a test of your faith? Have you had these kinds of thoughts or feelings ever? You've gone through something and you reflect back on it and you say it's a test of faith.
I guess sometimes it's hard to know what what some things happen really are. That's a test of your faith. You pray, you hope things will work out or come out.
Mm-hmm. Whenever you fail at something, you think maybe you were, was it what you were supposed to do in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
You missed the a corner somewhere.
Yeah, because the test of faith is a lot of times is the it's the possibility of not of doubting, but it's the possibility of not counting on God anymore, you know, in whatever circumstance that might be, where you no longer trust. And I think some of the things that were talked about last night in the forum, I don't know if some of you were there at that forum, but in one sense, you could look at an experience like September 11th for the families that experienced that, not to mention the rest of the nation, but just those families that lost somebody. I mean, in one sense, those could be for them tests of faith, you know, because what appears to be a rather senseless and meaningless experience. There's no reason that those people had to die. And there's no logical reason why those people, they happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, that they had to die. There's no good explanation for why, other than the fact that a plane crashed and killed them. But, you know, those could be tests of personal faith for people. In the sense of, you know, does God come into their life and help them deal with the after effects of that, or is that a moment in their personal walk where God no longer makes any difference? You know, those are for individuals tests of faith. I think about some of the things that the people that experienced the Holocaust. I mean, that to me has always been a huge thing for. And in this sense, not necessarily all Christian, but many Jews, but still they had a faith in God. Now, can they still believe in God after the Holocaust? You know, if they saw 6 million of their brothers and sisters die, is it possible to still have faith? And I think it's a very personal question. And sometimes people go through periods of time when they don't, when they feel like they have lost faith. And then you hear stories about individuals that, you know, they feel like they're in the wilderness, if you will, for a while, and all of a sudden out of the wilderness they come out and they see something and they become stronger. You know, and if we use Paul's life experience as sort of an example of that, I mean, there were lots and lots of times where, you know, it's very possible he could have lost faith. You know, after all these things. I mean, you think about, you know, I'm doing all these things to try and spread the gospel. I'm trying to do all these things. And people are dumping on me. They're not responding. They're not doing what I think they should do. The church is going crazy when I leave. You know, they throw me in jail. Or, you know, there's all these different possibilities of, if God, if you really want me to do this, then how come you're making it so difficult? So there's a lot to look at. I think that rather than the last couple of questions, I think are maybe more personal ones that you can reflect on. But you know, the importance of prayer in this whole faith business, and how important it is for us to stay in communication with God. I think the test of faith is, can we still pray even when we're in the midst of doubt? And of course, the most important question, of course, is a personal one, is what do we feel our calling is, and how do we feel personally led to be people of faith in whatever it is that we're doing in our lives?
I think through Paul you hear the fact that without all these hardships that he overcame, it just built up his faith so that there really wasn't anything he was afraid to tackle. Mm-hmm. And if he had just crumbled under the first test, he would have been like all the rest of us.
Right. Well, and I think that's true. And Luther said that in a lot of different ways. But, you know, the times we feel strongest are the times when we're the weakest. I mean, that's the whole irony of this thing. When we're totally dependent upon God, when all our physical and emotional and spiritual resources are depleted, that's when we have the closest relationship with God. And it's so different from, you know, the way we think about it, because, you know, in our culture and society, you know, we're taught to be strong, you got to be active, you got to be physically fit, you know, you got to do this and do that and be successful and all these types of things. And really, in terms of your spiritual life, when you lose everything is when you have the chance to be closest to God, which is a very interesting, kind of an ironic situation.
Can you substitute for the term lose, let go? Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's go say let go and let God is really a very nice way to remember that in your own personal walk, because you really do need to let go if God's going to be able to do what God wants to do with your life. Yeah, it's a control thing. It's definitely a control thing. And unfortunately, most of us, myself included, we like to control as much of things as we can. And really, faith is being out of control in that sense and allowing God to control us. Well, thank you, Ryan. It's a very interesting discussion. Thanks for your participation. And God bless you in your faith journey and your walk.
Have a safe trip back, Dad.
Well, I hope so.
You know. When do you play? Tomorrow.
Here's a cute story I saw in my book. It said, this minister was preaching on the evils of drink. He first said that he would like to gather up all the wine and dump it in the river. Then he moved on to the beer and said that he would like to get all the beer and dump it in the river, and then all other forms of alcohol to be dumped in the river. The choir director's face began to show a worried look. The first hymn that they were scheduled to sing was, Shall We Gather at the River?
Maybe somebody in the congregation would say, what river are you going to dump
that?
Yeah.